Whether fairly or not, George Carlin's name will always be associated most closely with his routine on seven words you can't say on television, which he first performed more than 35 years ago. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has these thoughts on how our attitudes about profanity have changed since then.
The Appreciations of George Carlin described him as a counterculture comedian. But the connection was really just circumstantial. Carlin was no hippie. Actually, I don't know that there were any hippie comedians apart from Cheech and Chong, or I guess maybe Sonny Bono if you want to push the point. Long hair and beard or no, Carlin was really the last hipster. The sardonic tone and scat riffing went straight back to Lenny Bruce, Mort Sahl, and Lord Buckley. And Carlin would have been the first to acknowledge his debt to Bruce for a lot of the elements in his routine on seven dirty words you can't say on television, like the ruminations on the grammar of profanity and the rapid-fire recitations of a string of dirty words like a kid pledging allegiance to the flag of some undeclared nation of the id. But it was Carlin's routine that entered American folklore and that stamped his identity as a performer. That's partly because Carlin's material was less confrontational and more ribald than Bruce's was. But it also reflected a cultural sea change. In their time, comics like Bruce and Sahl were relegated to the category of sick humor. Bruce himself disliked the label, though he used it in the title of a 1958 LP. But whoever spoke it, sick implied a deviation from normality that required a special dispensation in the name of art. When Bruce was arrested for obscenity in New York in 1964, a group of cultural luminaries, including Lionel Trilling, Susan Sontag, and Allen Ginsberg, issued a manifesto on his behalf. True, they said, Bruce's routine sometimes made use of what they called the vernacular. But they defended the language as essential to Bruce's satirical intent and went on to compare him to Swift and Rabelais. Actually, the adjective Rabelaisian probably fits Carlin a lot better than Bruce. But by the time Carlin started performing his dirty words routine a few years later, public profanity didn't require an artistic justification. It was a form of social protest in its own right. There's a telling moment in the movie Woodstock when Country Joe and the Fish engage the crowd in a call and response of the F word. Give me an F, F, give me a U, U, and so on. And then launch into their anti-war, feel like I'm fixin' to die rag, the one that goes, it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? The segue would have been bewildering a decade earlier, but by 1969, shouting the F-word had become a gesture of political liberation. It wasn't just that the stigma of the word embodied American sexual repression and hypocrisy, but that those very hang-ups were held to be responsible for the injustice and violence of the American system. As Jerry Rubin put it, how can you separate politics from sex? Puritanism led us to Vietnam. That connection between sexual and political repression was at the heart of Carlin's seven dirty words routine.
You know the seven, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, f***, suck a mother, huh? Those are the heavy seven. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war.
At the time, in fact, some people were making those charges in perfect seriousness. After the Chicago police beat up demonstrators outside the 1968 Democratic Convention, Vice President Hubert Humphrey defended the police actions by saying, "The obscenity, the profanity, the filth that was uttered night after night was an insult to every woman, every mother, every daughter. You'd put anybody in jail for that kind of talk." But that was a more innocent age. There may still be a lot of people who are disturbed by the tide of ambient vulgarity that was loosed in the 1960s, but nobody's really shocked by it anymore. It's been quite a while since you heard profanity denounced as subversive, much less as an insult to American womanhood. And in a more enlightened age, we don't put people in jail for talking dirty. It's more expedient simply to allow the FCC to fine broadcasters who air language that the agency deems indecent, thanks to the 1978 Supreme Court decision that grew out of a daytime broadcast of Carlin's routine by a Pacifica station in New York. Carlin himself never stopped speaking blue to power. He kept reworking the routine over the years to increasingly universal acclaim. That testified both to his elevation to cultural icon and his perceived irrelevance in a world that was awash in apolitical raunch. After his death, he was even paid tribute by the director of the Parents Television Council, the watchdog group that was set up to orchestrate a deluge of email to the FCC whenever Detective Sipowicz spoke his vernacular mind or when Diane Keaton let slip an unacceptable modifier on Good Morning America. But then the battle lines are drawn very differently now. In its next term, the Supreme Court will be taking up broadcast indecency for the first time since its 1978 decision. Only this time around, the case pits the FCC against Rupert Murdoch's Fox Broadcasting, and the offenses involve expletives that Cher and Nicole Richie dropped during the Billboard Music Awards. It's sad to think that we'll never get to hear Carlin go to work on a lineup like that one. But I've got a pretty good idea which side he would have come down on in the end.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.